Rest and I are more prone to
that's a real problem. It's going toward the
okay.
Good afternoon. I'll call over the State Government Budget Division for Wednesday, March 21, 2007. Let the record reflect a quorum is present. We'll start with Senate File 1081, Minnesota Commission on New Americans Establishment and Appropriation. Senator Rest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1081 establishes a Commission on New Americans, and was heard in the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. It's here because it has an appropriation in it to support the work of this new commission, which charged with bringing together the immigrant community, the business community, legislators to look at ways in which the assets that new Minnesotans bring to our state can be leveraged for economic stability and future, particularly in development of the workforce. Which we have been told by the state demographer and the state economist, in the next couple of decades, we're going to be 100,000 workers short. So they told us also that we need to make sure that people that settle in Minnesota, we make the most out of the skills that they bring and enhance them. The appropriation was to be to the from the general fund to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Mr. Chairman, I've talked with you about appropriate way of dealing with that through the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and I don't have any amendments to the bill. We had put the special appropriation there, and it may be appropriate at this point to just remove it.
To remove what? The Section 2? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, deal with the actual dollars that would be going to support this effort through the Legislative Coordinating Commission's overall appropriation, but I'm open to whatever suggestions you or the committee may have.
Sure. I mean, we could eliminate Section 2. I don't know that eliminates the fiscal note, because there still might be a cost which has to be considered. And we can do, mainly if it's for the per diem and so forth that is going to be done here. I've talked to you informally. I think a couple of things we might look at is, one way or the other, the bill has to move from the Budget Division to the Full Finance Committee. Tomorrow, the Full Finance Committee is going to be taking up the State Government Budget Omnibus Bill. It is possible that if this Budget Division approves this bill, we could roll that in there. But you also have appointments made by legislators, so it might be appropriate to maybe roll the language into the budget bill and still send maybe the bill out on its own to the Rules Committee.
It's already been to the Rules Committee.
Oh, this has been the Rules Committee.
This is, yeah,
okay,
this,
so they've already
this has gone to State and Local Government and the Rules
Committee.
They approved it.
Oh, great.
And I actually put put in $10,000 a year to meet the per diem issue. And then, so it can go back to the Finance Committee and to the floor without a... We had talked about the possibility of just going ahead and putting it in the state government budget bill and having it dealt with there, which is just fine with me. But it's already met the standard of going to the Rules Committee for their approval.
Given the fact that there is a fiscal note, I don't know that deleting Section 2 is going to change anything ultimately, though. The Finance Committee is going to have to look at it. So I think by leaving Section 2 in the bill, just reminds us that there's a cost here, and the Finance Committee can figure out what to do on that part. So
and
I think, Mr.
Hubinger had indicated that he thought that would be very sufficient to cover the per diem for this group.
Okay. Are there any questions of Senator Rest on Senate File 1081? Senator Olstein.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, you don't feel this is duplicating some of the other committees we have, like Asian Pacific and all of those that...
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olstein, no, I don't. In fact, it would be something that would be unique in the country to have a commission that was looking specifically at the issues of workforce development issues, language issues of new immigrants.
Thank you.
And the commission, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olstein, actually is encouraged to consult with the Commission on Asian Pacific Islanders, et cetera, in the makeup of their membership.
Any other questions of the author? And is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on it? We're only looking mainly at the budget issues because this bill has already been heard, the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee and then the Rules Committee. So if none, then Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1081 be recommended passed to the Finance Committee. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman.
Then we have Senate File 1073, Public Employment Labor Agreements and Compensation Plans Ratification. Mm-hmm. Senator Scheid, welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1073 is State Employee Contract Ratification Bill. It includes two collective bargaining agreements and one compensation plan in the executive branch, and then it also approves a salary increase for the head of the Gambling Control Board. And it was that requested by the governor. And that was requested by the governor. This is something that we do need to ratify, otherwise they... the contract, which I have been imposed or living by these contracts now, but we need to pass this to so they don't become void.
And these are not costs that we have to come up with the money in because these come out of the agency's fund. Is that correct, Mr. Linda? Yes. So these aren't. I mean, there's always a cost when you approve a contract, but we don't have to come up with the money to pay for them. The agencies do. And this also was heard in the State and Local Government Operations Oversight Committee as well, too. So.
Mr. Chairman, that's where it came from.
Okay. Is there any questions about Senate File 1073? And is there anybody here who wants to be heard on Senate File 1073? Senator
Olstein. Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid. I'm not sure if I understand this completely because these are existing contracts. Is that correct? It says like 2006 on there.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Senator Olstein, these are contracts that were settled later after the legislature
adjourned.
After we adjourned, yeah.
And the legislature has to have ratified the contracts.
Okay.
We don't have to, but that's the process that, you know, we're supposed to, in order for them to take effect, the legislature ratifies them. So. Okay. Senator Olstein moves then that Senate File 1073 be recommended passed in the Finance Committee. Is there a discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
Mr. Chairman.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I was not aware of, I had not seen the fiscal note on this bill. And I see that the...
And you're referring back to your bill,
my
so 1081,
bill.
Yes.
I was
yes.
not aware of that, and I think that that's a very expensive cost and was not what I intended.
Okay.
And... in particular, that the fiscal note says that there would be an expenditure for one half of a additional staff person for the commission, and I see that that probably is coming from them saying that the let's see where it is, in subdivision four, that the Legislative Coordinating Commission would provide administrative and clerical support necessary. I certainly would be willing to have that removed to lessen the fiscal impact, because it's that which causes the fiscal note to be more than just paying for the per diem, and to have the legislative staff as part of their own duties to take care of that. That would be $57,000 of the
fiscal note
of the cost. And I hadn't seen this before. Okay. I'm sorry. I wonder if we could reconsider that.
Senator Rust moves that the vote whereby Senate File 1081 was recommended pass be reconsidered. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. We have before Senate File 1081. And Senator Rust, would it be your intention then on page 2 to delete lines 17 through 19?
Subdivision 4.
Okay. Senator Rust moves to on page 2. To delete subdivision 4, which is lines 17 through 19. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Anything further?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Rest, how is this going to operate then? What would be the role of the Legislative Coordinating Commission?
In this instance, only to convene the first meeting.
Mm-hmm. And then
that shouldn't cost anything.
Right. And then the rest of it will be done by legislative staff during the interim.
Yes.
Why not? Make use of our legislative staff during the interim.
I'm trying to be
absolutely
fiscally conservative here, because I believe, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, this is an extremely important initiative, but I'm not out to make it cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And to the extent that there are costs, which would be per diem, those would be coming out of the legislative budget.
Right.
Okay. A further discussion on Senate File 1081 as amended. Senator Rust moves that Senate File 1081 as amended be recommended pass be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The amendment to the bill is passed.
Second. Mr. Chairman. Would that mean that we could receive a new fiscal note?
I would imagine, Mr. Lindina. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I hope they get it done quickly. Okay. When we finished the budget bill last week, we sent it to Finance, and it'll be heard tomorrow in the Finance Committee. We did not wrap up the Secretary of State's portion of it. Now, I had introduced a bill, which is Senate File 1679, which outlined some of the initiatives of the Secretary of State. What the plan today is to pick up some of the provisions that we had already looked at but pulled out of the bill and kept them here. Senator Torres Ray had Senate File 1346. You have the fiscal note. As well as her bill, Senator Larson had the voter registration of a driver's license bill, Senate File 1297. We've had those things here. And so in your packet, you should have a delete all, which includes some of those things, but also some new initiatives by the Secretary of State. I believe that it would be basically budget neutral to do that, and it has to be, obviously, because what in the plan would be that if this is approved, to then amend this on to Senate File 1679, send that to the Finance Committee, and then have this tomorrow morning amend whatever the committee chooses to, Budget Division chooses to do, amend that on to the budget bill in the Finance Committee. So the Secretary of State's portion will be in the budget bill as a separate article. Let me turn it over. Who'd be best to go first? Okay, I'll ask Mr. Bodden to go through the A4 delete all amendment, and he can describe what is in the delete all amendment, and then Mr. Lundeen can describe the fiscal issues that we have before us. Mr. Bodden.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just take you through the A4 amendment and let you know where which sections came from, which bills it came from. If you look at Section 1 on the A4 amendment, that is from Senator Torres-Ray's bill, Senate File 1346, I believe. That's just some of the general changes made in the Secretary of State omnibus bill. Section 2 is new language. This is a proposal from the Secretary of State's office, and that imposes a 2-year temporary surcharge on filing fees for various forms of corporate organization. You can see them listed in clauses 1 through 5 together with the surcharge. And again, that's limited to 2 years. It expires June 30th, 2009.
And the Secretary of State is going to be testifying. Their office will be testifying on this a little later.
The amount of the revenues from the surcharges will be deposited into the Uniform Commercial Code account. And then later in the bill, you'll see a standing appropriation that just appropriates the money in that account for improvements, basically improvements to their filing system. We did hear a bill that dealt with those changes, or I think it was a budget proposal. Then looking at the bottom of page 1, section 3 is taken from, that's from Senator Larson's bill. This is the automatic voter registration provisions, and that is true for the, and I'll, if there are any changes that were made in any of these provisions, I'll highlight them, but otherwise they're as the bill was heard before the division. That takes you all the way through, I believe, page 4. The sections through there. At the bottom of page 6, this is another provision from Senate File 1346, and just having to do with technical changes to corporate registration. That's pretty much true for the, these do have a fiscal impact, and Mr. Lundeen can talk a little bit more about how that works and the amount of, the dollar amount of that impact. That would be true for the remaining sections in the bill all the way through to the last page on page 8. Section 10 on page 8 takes a provision that was from the chair's bill, Senate File 1679, appropriating money from the Help America Vote Act account for federally authorized purposes and uses. That's a 2-year appropriation there of what should be the entire amount in that account. Subdivision 2 in Section 10 would take care of any balance that might be remaining in that account in the out years, basically makes the same appropriation available until June 30th, 2011. Then in Subdivision 3, you see the appropriation of the technology surcharges in Section 2 that I referred to earlier. And that's pretty much it.
And Mr. Lundeen, we have a spreadsheet dealing just with this amendment. Could you go through this and tell us what we're looking at here?
Sure. And the spreadsheet is based on the fiscal note that we had for Senate File 1346, and then meeting with the Secretary of State's office on how much the surcharge would bring in, and these numbers have been run by the Department of Finance, and I believe we're all in agreement. First on the spreadsheet is the direct appropriations that from the HAVA account that Mr. Bodern went through. Then those are the only direct appropriations in the bill. The rest will be statutory. And the first one on the spreadsheet is in Section 9. This is to standardize the online and paper filing fees to make it a standard $20. The online previously was $15 and the paper was $20. So this is kind of standardizing it, and this is showing the amount of new revenue that the Secretary of State's office expects to get in. And when we did hear Senate File 1346, the Secretary of State's office talked about that these new dollars would be used for basically to cover the remote payment fees or the $3 credit card fee for online filings. Moving down then, we get to the temporary technology surcharge, which is in Sections 2 and 10. And these dollars the Secretary of State is going to use for their business services technology improvements and to maintain two business filing positions. And they talked about these proposals when they were in with their budget proposal. At that time, they were talking about using general fund dollars and that. But given the general fund dollars were short, this technology surcharge revenues were raised and appropriated to cover these costs. Then moving down to the revenue, this is basically the money that's being appropriated in the statutory appropriations, the amount of money that's coming into the special revenue account for the online and paper filing fee increases, and then for the technology surcharge. And then this just lists the changes in the fees that are actually listed in Section 2 and the amount of revenue that each will bring in. And these revenue estimates are basically based on the most recent information they had from calendar year 06. Then we move down to some, there's some impacts to the general fund, and these were contained in Senate File 1346. There's an increase of revenue based on the number of copies and increasing that fee by $3 of $2,000 each fiscal year. And then there's a decrease in a fee, the non-Minnesota name reservation fee, by $15. And the net result of that is a loss to the general fund of $3,000. So overall, we have a loss to the general fund each fiscal year of $1,000. Now, in the original fiscal note that we got from the Secretary of State's office on this bill, there were some savings that would accrue to the Secretary of State's office, and those are contained with the changes in Section 6, which eliminates the post-dissolution process notice. So the Secretary of State's office said there would be some postage and printing cost savings there of approximately $4,000 per year. At this point, we are not capturing those savings, and in order to make the bill balance, if this is added to the budget bill and finance, we'll probably have to make a small adjustment to the general fund appropriation of the Secretary of State's office.
So we really don't have a lot of new initiatives so far. These are things we've already looked at. This is now paying for them by using the HAVA money for the voter stuff, and then the fees to help pay for the technology. That's basically what we've got here, right? Is there somebody from the Secretary of State's office who wants to comment on the proposal that we have here? Welcome back to the Budget Division, and please identify yourself for the record again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beth Fraser with the Secretary of State's office. I also have Mr. Black with me, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Is there anything further you want to point out in any of this here? We'd already looked at the initiatives before, and this is a way to pay for them. Senator Rest.
I just have a question. Initially, as you know, Ms. Fraser, I had questioned the policy of the automatic registration, and I've since changed my mind about that and do believe it's a good way to go. But it occurs to me that now if we're going to have all these people registered, that we're not going to be who otherwise wouldn't be, we're not going to have the turnout. Our percentage is going to go down. Instead of being first in the country, we're probably not going to be close
people.
Because we're going to have so a lot of people registered automatically who otherwise wouldn't
what
be registered, who aren't going to vote. And I was just wondering if you were prepared for Minnesota falling out of first place in voter turnout.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rust, actually, there's not a large need to worry about that. Currently, when they look at voter turnout rates, they look at there are two different measures. One is percentage turnout from registered voters. The other percentage that's looked at is turnout from eligible voters. And we're actually very high already in both categories. And so since we're already very high in the number of, in the percentage of voters who are eligible who turn out, that number will stay the same. Although we are hoping that government agencies like ours and groups out there will be able to spend less time registering voters and more time focused on voter education and getting out the vote.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted us to be prepared in case there seemed to be an anomaly at the next election that if this goes through, that there may be some effect that we are not anticipating, but maybe not. We'll see.
Ms. Fraser, when you say eligible voters, are those people that are registered or could be registered? How do we define eligible voters?
Mr. Chair, eligible voters are defined as adults over 18 or older and not felons and citizens.
Whether or not they are registered?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so if we have a high turnout already of eligible voters, presumably they have to register at the polls or something. So you're saying that by registering through this motor vehicle registration, they're going to be eligible either way, and they're now going to be registered. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions on the financing part? Mr. Black, did you have anything on the fees or anything that you wanted to point out?
Mr. Chair and members, Bert Black, Legal Advisor, Secretary of State's Office. Just to let you know that we had the opportunity this morning to visit with the Executive Council of the Business Law Section of the Bar Association, and while they did not take a vote, they did understand the business case for this and were supportive, generally.
Okay. And they apparently understand that nobody wants to pay more fees, but they're going to at least point to something they're going to get out. This isn't going to get sucked into the general fund. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the A4 amendment? Anybody else who's here? If not, Senator Olstein moves the A4 amendment. Discussion on that. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion on Senate File 1679 as amended? And members, again, the plan is to forward this to the Finance Committee, but then when we take it up tomorrow, that the contents of this bill would be rolled into the omnibus bill, which we'll take up on the floor, I think, on Saturday. I think that's still the plan. It was an hour ago anyway. So. Okay. Any further discussion? Senator Olstein moves that Senate File 1679 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And then the other item of business today, Deloitte and Touche had indicated an availability to discuss the funding options for the government reform, particularly the drive to excellence, some of the things that they have learned. And since we have been talking about it, and I raised the issue that we've got the drive to excellence that's supposed to make us more efficient, where are the savings and so forth, I don't know if this is going to quite answer all that, but we do have some people here who can talk about those things. So is Mr. Dahl here? Yes.
Yes.
Please, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Great, thank you. I'm Steve Dahl, director with Deloitte Consulting, LLP in Minneapolis. Just by way of background, I've been with Deloitte for about 18 years, and I lead our consulting services we provide here at the state of Minnesota, as well as leading our practice across the Midwest part of the United States. On the Drive to Excellence, since you mentioned that as well, I was our lead on our efforts around the Drive to Excellence initiative. So thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I'd like to share a few ideas and thoughts and have a good dialogue around this. I've got a few materials up there for you. One is a book where a number of these materials come from, which is one we've just recently published, and we've got earmarked for you towards the back a chapter on transforming state government that I co-authored. So a lot of these materials come from that. And then I've also got a presentation document that I'd like to walk through with you, and please interrupt me with questions and thoughts as we go through. On the first slide, I really just wanted to give a little background on transformation in general. Is the way we look at it, the way I look at it is certainly we can all do more with more, and we can all do less with less, but to do more with less, fundamentally, we have to do the work differently, and we have to think differently. And that's really what transformation is all about, is looking at things from an enterprise point of view and looking at the overall state from an enterprise point of view, looking at the linkages between programs and business processes, looking to make processes and technologies uniform, more consistent, both in methodology and tool sets, and then organizing services from a business or citizen perspective rather than the agency perspective, and then utilizing shared services wherever practical or possible to share all the investments that you make in infrastructure. The next page is just some questions that always look at and ask around government transformation. Are you ready? Are your people ready? What's the issue you're trying to solve, and can you engage key stakeholders? And certainly here in Minnesota, we've done a lot of work in this area. around assessment and strategy and developing business cases and developing a very significant state team and structure that is working on reform. There's a lot of desire to make reform happen. On what's the issue is around obviously preparing for the future, better access to service, quality improvements, access improvements, savings as well. And the Kenny engaged the key stakeholders. It's really understanding kind of who cares about these things and why do they care and how does that impact what we're doing. So those are typical questions that we work through in the process that are very important at this front end of transformation. And I know you've and we've together done a lot of work in that. The last bullet point is, can you get the resources? And that's really where the rubber hits the road on transformation initiatives. And options include certainly traditional internal funding through appropriations, which I know you've been working on, outsourcing or managed services, and various leasing arrangements are three much more traditional type options that people have looked at. There are three additional that I've identified there. One is bonding, the second is investment funds, and the third is value-based or performance-based contracts. Those are what I'll call the new wave or trend of activities. We've seen a lot of movement on in funding these types of initiatives. So the next several pages, I'd like to just give a quick overview and some thoughts around each of those as options for you to consider as you go through this process. The next page on bonding for technology, really this is what I'll call a bit of a change in mindset and looking at technology as core infrastructure, similar as you looked to building or other aspects of that are really required to get your business done. And the National Association of State CIOs, in a study they did on innovative funding for innovative state IT in November of 2003, they had roughly just a little less than half of the states already at that point in time were using bonding to fund major technology initiatives. So this is a very important way that a lot of states are looking at paying for these significant investments in infrastructure. There's a listing of some of the different typical requirements, and on the next page some of the benefits, but obviously it really gets to a way to capture very significant dollars needed for infrastructure investments that aren't always available in the general fund. By way of example, Massachusetts, on page 4, you see that there has done three major bond initiatives around technology from 1992 to 2002, which have raised over $700 million specifically for technology investments, funding a lot of their reform.
Let me pause there and ask a question. I mean, in the classic sense, when we bond for things, you know, these are for long-term projects, and once the bonds are paid off, you still have the roads, the buildings, whatever it is that you use to build them. Technology has been so rapidly changing. Isn't there the risk that with bonding, you're basically putting something on the credit card, and at some point you may still be paying for some technology years from now after you no longer are using that technology because things went off in a different direction, you did other things. So isn't, you know, why should we put things, why should we bond for stuff that is going to be rapidly changing like that?
Mr. Chairman, it's a good question and something that always needs to be looked at with, you know, any of these initiatives. And, you know, you have technology systems at the state that have been in service for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. So whereas true technology changes, a lot of the core systems that are the core infrastructure operating programs in the state, you know, have a lifespan of, you know, a decade or more. So it does provide at least that as an option for funding when you're looking at technology initiatives of that nature.
John Barr?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess kind of piggybacking off of what you said, and maybe this is going to be part of the presentation or how we deal with it, but I can kind of see some potential correlations here when we talk about changing over to an electronic licensing system where we just looked at, you know, some increased fees and things. If we bonded to put the infrastructure in place to accomplish these, we might be able to get increased fees. We have an increased service for our population, and to get some of these programs off the ground, and maybe that's how you're going to come around to doing this, but I just thought I'd piggyback off of some of your ideas and how we stay open-minded when we're looking at some of these potential ideas.
Well, the bonding initiatives do give you some quick money, but payment's going to have to come at some point. You're going to get the invoice in the mail, and you got to pay it. So.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm saying, Mr. Chair, is if we looked at a $25 increase on licenses, that if we put this electronic licensing in place, we get a benefit as, you know, I'm licensed on a number of different levels at the state, so I see a lot of benefit on being able to do all of that online and taking care of the renewals and things that would be worth it in my time as a business owner. So I think we need to look at both ends of the spectrum if we're changing over some of these technologies.
Okay.
That's one option, and if you go to page 5, let's touch on a second option that I outlined at the front, which is really internal investment funds. And what that is a pool of dollars that are set aside to do various, typically pilot projects, trying new technology, and looking at projects with shorter payback periods. And that can be technology, or it can be other projects. It's very often used to pay for any kind of reform project. I point you to the second bullet point there is one that I find to be very critical, and that's the state legislature may provide initial seed money to establish such investment funds, and then savings generated by funded projects can be used to replenish the investment funds. A number of states have these funds at this point, some of them with the initial seed money and some without. And the general concept is if you don't have the initial seed money, it's looking at a way to do internal charges to recoup the investments. And the challenge that that folks run into with that is what I'll call one of timing, in that if you have a major project you're doing or even a smaller project you're doing that happens in year one, the savings then typically come that would pay that back typically come in years 2 and 3. Depending on that timing and how that fits with the budget cycle, you may not be able to do the internal billings and paybacks for that to that revolver within that time period. So it's important that there's some amount of seed money sitting there to cover that, I'll call it, lapse period between the fiscal years. If you look at on the next page on slide 6, there's really a couple examples of and how to, different organizations have come up with that initial seed money. First is the Philadelphia Productivity Bank. They actually used bond money, $20 million worth, to seed the initial technology revolver fund or investment fund, and then grant loans for these initiatives, and then those have a payback period, and then from the savings, those are captured and used to pay back the loans such that that fund lives on. South Carolina, the way they grabbed their seed money was allowing carryover of unused budget appropriations into a savings account for technology projects. A third one I'll mention real briefly is Tennessee, and they developed a system development fund, and they used $10 million in a one-time legislative appropriation to get their initial seed money. So, yes.
Ms. Arrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have had proposals similar to this coming up here as well, and not exactly done this way, but one that I have that's being carried in the transportation bill was to capture our percentage every time we have a budget surplus over a certain amount to capture 25% of that into an investment fund, if you will, that is separately stated, invested with our State Board of Investment, and then the earnings, 5%, be used specifically for transportation projects. And it looks like that you know, it seems to me that that's a good model for taking one-time money that you can't, can't always depend upon, but you can get a corpus of dollars that are separate from the instability of the general fund and try and make those one-time surplus dollars into a stable source of funding for any number of mm-hmm. initiatives, whether we would do it here, whether we would do it for technology, which, of course, has an ongoing need and needs to be rejuvenated all the time, or we're underfunding significantly a priority that many people give lip service to, and that is early childhood education. We could be doing it that way, capturing one-time money and making it stable, and that seems to be the approach that that's being used in some other states to do exactly the same thing with technology.
It is a common approach, a coming trend. And I would say, though, you know, real important factor and baseline on each of these that I'm talking about, and I'll talk a little bit later in the presentation about how to capture some of these savings, but a real important factor is to make it an ongoing stream, mm-hmm. is once those loans for the initiatives are laid out, there has to be a way to capture the cash and pay them back.
Right.
And that's not an easy item to work through, but we do have an approach and methodology that we've utilized, and I'll be talking about that in a minute as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. If you go to page 7, the next option or area is value-based billing. And I'm going to talk about value-based billing and performance contracts together, and there's a lot of detail laid out over the next number of slides, but I'll try to just get to the point on these. What these are ways to share the risk between the state and vendors, a way to capture some outside funding when funding isn't readily available, and a way to also hold vendors more accountable and perhaps optimize their performance. So basically what the concept of a value-based billing project looks at is, say, the state will identify, here's the issue, here's what we see needs to get done, and the vendor community looks at it and say, here's a proposal on how to solve that problem. And that proposal is looking at, there's a view that there's an ability to capture additional savings or new revenues that have a stream that, if the project is successful, the vendor is paid through that new money. So the vendor is taking a lot of risk in funding most of the initiative upfront themselves, based on their experience and belief that if this project is done well and right, the dollars will be there to pay for the initiative through a new revenue stream or a savings stream. Very often these are being used now for things such as a strategic sourcing project, where looking at procurement reform, being used very often for re-engineering projects, being used for technology projects that drive new revenues or have the opportunity to drive new revenues, such as tax systems and licensing. So this is arrangement that requires a very close collaboration and relationship between the vendor and the state to make it work. But it is one that we're seeing quite a bit of. Back in the early and mid-90s, we really didn't see it hardly at all. Today, we're seeing it as a very significant stream of activity in how these projects are being funded and paid for. So a very important factor, if you look at the last bullet point on page 7, very important factor to make these value-based projects work is that there has to be a readily identifiable and objective either savings stream or revenue stream that everyone can agree upon. Otherwise, these efforts unravel in a dispute over, well, was the savings X or was the savings Y? So it has to be real clear how that's what the process is to getting that number and what those numbers are, so that those savings can be appropriately shared between the state and the vendor to pay for the project.
And if there are no savings, in fact, is there any losses? Is that negotiated too?
Yes, and that's where that's the risk sharing part. Mm-hmm. So there's an upside and a downside put into those contracts to say, based on the assumptions laid out in the project and in the contract, there's a revenue stream set up that would say, if everything goes the way is planned, the vendor would have $1,000 of input, and they would get paid, they would get paid $1,000 plus some type of risk-based charge or interest charge to cover the time that they've been not paid for. And then there would be an upside. If the project goes much better than expected, the vendor would get some kind of additional compensation for the risks they're taking. And conversely, if the project doesn't achieve its results, the vendor would either get no payment or get a much lower payment amount. And that's the attractiveness that not only in public sector, private sector really sees in this kind of an arrangement, because it really shares the risk and puts a lot of the onus on the vendors to, if you don't perform, you don't get paid. If this project doesn't work, we're all of us have our goose cooked, really, from that standpoint. So there's a lot of attractiveness to this kind of project, and it's becoming a very big trend.
I don't know if the analogy is a good one, but it seems to me that we try to get some contractors interested in helping Crosstown, and Senator Larson, you know more about that, and nobody wanted to do that. So it just seems to me most vendors want money up front. But Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dahl, this seems to me similar to what energy companies have done, where they'll say, we'll audit your building, mm-hmm. we'll see what needs to be done, we'll upgrade the energy improvements, and we'll guarantee that those improvements will be paid for with energy savings.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I'm hearing. Is that similar to that?
That's a similar concept. And the point on Crosstown is a good one. When any vendor would look at these projects, they have to go in and really be convinced that that the savings are there, that there's the revenue stream is there, such that the risk reward ratio on the project makes sense for them. So there's that's the whole collaborative part. There tends to be a lot of due diligence around it, because in essence, in those types of a project, the state is asking the vendor to take on a lot of this risk, and so they have to be very comfortable with the assumptions and the details of the contract, et cetera, that they feel like they're going to get paid.
Sir Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to comment on the Crosstown thing, too, because I've been involved in the construction industry for many years. The way government pays and the way the private industry pays are two separate things, and part of the problem comes in when we as the government step in and say, gee, we want to change our way of doing things. Well, the contractors are saying, oh, we're kind of used to the government giving us the money up front. That the scenario doesn't work in the private sector. The private sector does not pay that kind of amounts of money up front in that kind of payment structure. So it's kind of that we've always done it this way. We always want to do it this way. So we need to think outside the box sometimes and restructure some of the things we do as government to maybe more mirror private industry on some things, but not on everything either. So I'm not advocating it straight across the board.
But at some point, everybody knows the government's going to have to buy computers and have to do stuff. So, why not let us spend our dollars and then somebody else will come along and, help us use them? I don't know, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jungbauer makes an interesting point. And I think the difference with the Crosstown is the Crosstown proposal, as it related to financing with contractor upfront money, really didn't come out of innovation. It came out of desperation. Mm. And I think that's perhaps the difference.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. And for any contractor to buy into a proposal that says, gosh, we just can't find the money, but don't worry, we'll make sure we're able to pay you back when we need to.
Yeah.
So I think, I think there is some possibility for, a future look at innovative, out-of-the-box ideas, but they have to come from the spirit of innovation, and, mm-hmm. Then I think people might be more open to them.
You're saying those contractors sense some desperation on that one?
A little bit, Mr. Chair.
I see. Okay. They are pretty good. Okay. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, I'd like to do a follow-up on that to Senator Larson as well, because I put in a road last year. The contractor really didn't check my credit, didn't know that much about me, and put in the road first and then billed me later. So in real life, you can get the contractor to go out there and put up all the money up front and then hope he gets paid. I'd say the government's probably a better credit risk than I potentially am.
Well, maybe you weren't as desperate. Mr. Dahl.
All right. I'll just conclude on the value-based billing option and say in our research in this area, somewhere north of a third of the states right now are using this in one form or another to pay for transformation projects. So it is something, if you look back at a decade ago, you didn't see this hardly at all, but now it is a coming trend. On page 10, I talk a little bit about performance-based contract, and it's really a little bit of a variation on value-based billing. But really what it gets to in a performance-based contract is, where value-based billing, you're typically asking the vendor to take a very significant amount of the risk around the project and the related payment. Performance-based is really a lesser amount of risk. So, in other words, you might lay out a target and say, our expectation, you might have a half a dozen different performance measures and say, our expectation to make this project go forward is that these half a dozen things get met. And if those are met, you're going to get paid $1,000. And if they don't get met, you're going to get paid $700. But if you dramatically exceed those expectations, in other words, you've really delivered, we'll pay you $1,500. And so it really ties. There's no, the full amount of the contract or the majority of the contract isn't typically at risk, but you put a reasonable amount at risk to incent success and really put, I guess the term that's often used is have the vendor put some skin in the game for those contracts. And it's a very popular mechanism, and really most all of states and local governments are utilizing those in some form or another at this point in time. That gets through the background and thoughts on some additional options and how you pay for transformational initiatives. I would like to go on slide 12 and talk about what we laid out as a 10-step process for how you capture the savings and how you validate savings. And this is in the book as well. But what we found over the last few years is there really wasn't a good comprehensive method or approach that was being used in both public and private sector to get to these kind of numbers. So we worked on a project with the state of Illinois to try to capture and understand the savings and put those in perspective for a variety of folks there over the last few years. And that's really this 10-step process is an outgrowth of that. But it's a fundamentally important item to each of the different alternative payment streams or options that we talked about, is how do you capture the savings, how do you measure the savings, and what's real here. The first step in the process is really getting everyone on board with what are we doing and why are we doing it, make sure there's a good understanding there. The second one is perhaps the most critical point in the process, and that's developing a strong baseline and agreeing on that baseline. So when we're measuring what has been saved, agreeing on what's the starting point. And it's very difficult to go back and capture savings when that hasn't been agreed upon up front, because you'll have a half a dozen different people might have a half a dozen different ideas of what that starting point should have been. And so you get multiple answers then on what you actually saved. So getting that strong baseline is really critical, and it's important that's done up front. And have that agreement up front, because it's you can get it when you go backwards on capturing the savings, but it's very difficult. The third point is looking at and coming to agreement on what kinds of savings are count. What do you do with one-time savings? What do you do with cost avoidance? So if we build a new system that allows everyone to go online to do different services, and one of the cost avoidances of that is you didn't have to build a building for a new facility for people to walk up to. What do you do with that savings, that cost avoidance savings? Does that count or not? And coming to agreement around some of those types of items. The fourth point is making sure that whole process is transparent, there's clear accountability, and that there's records that goes back to general ledgers, vendor payments, other kinds of things that are really stand up to public scrutiny. And then fifth, defining savings categories or types of savings, inventory and all the projects. And then after that, it's really crunching the numbers, crunching the savings numbers, backing out or subtracting what the investments were to get to those savings so you get a return on an investment. And then last point is to make sure that the capturing what were some of the non-cash savings benefits. Now, I'll get to one of the – there are a couple of points that even when you go through this process are very difficult to get to, and that's what I'll call the difference between on – this is what item 10 is really getting to, what I call soft dollar savings versus hard dollar savings. So if you have a process redesign or improvement that now it's somebody in their job, a third of the time they spend on their job, they don't have to spend doing some kind of transaction moving paper anymore, and now they can use that third of the time to to serve a customer. Well, that's truly a savings in the process, but you probably haven't eliminated their job, so it's a soft savings. And how do you capture those dollars when it comes to budgeting and paying back a loan of any kind? So how do you capture those, and what are the rules of the road that you want to put together around those? And that's a very difficult one to deal with. But then the second part is then looking at, okay, what do we really consider hard cash savings, and how can we take those hard cash savings, an agreement on how we'll be able to take those and utilize that to pay, whether it's pay for a bond, pay back an investment fund, pay to a vendor on a value-based billing arrangement. How exactly is that going to work, and what is, you know, kind of the show me the money, where is the cash on those? That's a very difficult number to get to if you haven't gone through this whole process up front.
Well, let me pose, obviously, you know, we've got all these computers, we've got more technology, more is on the way. We're becoming more and more efficient, more and more effective.
Yep.
Yet there's no savings. I mean, we're just finding more ways to do things.
More.
It costs more. It just keeps adding up. One of the suggestions that you made was that, you know, if there was a negotiated agreement between, say, an agency and a vendor, the vendor says, okay, you know, you want to have a better way of tracking your procurement, for example, mm-hmm. we can do that for you. We'll enter the contract, and there'll be some benchmarks in here so that if we save, you know, certain money, then we, the vendor, should get that reward. Well, from my standpoint, as somebody, from this budget division standpoint, as we're trying to look at numbers here from agencies, what are the savings that we can look at when you're going to be paying the money out to the vendors, you know, for all this efficiency, and there really isn't anything more that we can deal with because we're more and more efficient, except that somebody else is getting the money we're spending to be more efficient. I think it becomes a little bit, you know, maybe government isn't meant to do this, but, you know, I haven't read the book yet. But how do I get there, you know, by, you know, giving all these savings out to you know, the private vendors?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, a couple of things on that. One is most often in those agreements, the savings or the new revenue, as, you know, new revenue in a tax system example, the savings in a procurement or other reengineering kind of example. But in most cases, what is agreed on is a savings split between the state and the vendor. So in other words, the state's not putting all the money up, up front. The vendor's taking a lot of the risk, and the way it gets paid for is through savings or through new revenues, what have you. But not all of the savings and not all of the revenue goes to the vendor. There's a split there, a sharing. There's a sharing of risk, and then there's a sharing of reward. And what percentage that is depends and varies quite a bit depending on a given project or arrangement in the contract. Second thing is that then there's typically an end for the vendor. So in other words, maybe it takes 3 years or however many years to 5 years, whatever the number is, depending on the project, for the vendor to get whole, to get all their payments to come in. Well, at that point, there's an end date, and from that point forward, the state carries all the savings going forward.
Except we have to recapture our investment, too, just as the vendor does, too.
Right.
So. Senator Elsin?
Yes. This kind of reminds me of the battle between sort of school district contract bus or have their bus service within house. You know, and to me, it comes down to the final point is that a vendor is not going to do this for free. They're going to have a profit yep. built in there. So that I would suspect that the state could do something very similar themselves with maybe with a bond, and then with the efficiencies that we keep hearing about with computer mm-hmm. systems, you know, theoretically pay back the bonds internally instead of doing the same thing with an external vendor. I'd be more comfortable maybe doing it that process, because as somebody who's going to put up millions of dollars in computer equipment is not going to be doing this for the fun of it.
Yep, that's a very fair statement, and that's why I laid out the first two options, which are internal mechanisms for funding these types of the bonding and in the revolver fund, really gets to the state taking on the funding, but also then capturing all the reward as well. Yeah.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Dahl. We've already gone through, obviously, our budget process, but it's kind of interesting to look back and see what other options might be available to us down the road. So
I do have one last
question. Oh, Senator Elsin, one more question.
Mr. Dahl, are there companies, turnkey companies now, that will come in and say, you know, your revenue system needs a revenue department needs $46 million in a new computer system? We'll front that. Can that be done now?
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, it depends on how the deals are structured, but there's examples all around the country of where we and other vendors have done that.
Thanks.
Other questions? Okay, well, members, I don't know what other bills are still floating around that we may have to look at, so we don't know. So if there's anything, we may have to look at something if it's fiscal impacts, we'll schedule. But, of course, starting the rest of this week, we're going to be getting into longer floor sessions with the omnibus bills and the conference committee. So, as I said, if we have any more meetings this session, we'll see you then. Allison Pembroke, our page, this is her last meeting because she's got her real job now. She's going to be Senator Anderson's legislative assistant, so you'll still see her around, just not here. So anything else before this? I do look forward to your support on the floor on Saturday, and wish me luck tomorrow on the hated dreaded Finance Committee. So Senator Pappas had an easy job, but they're waiting for others.
Keep all our provisions in there, Mr. Chair.
I'll fight as hard as I can for you. Okay, so meeting adjourned. Okay, thank you.